Two Brothers, One Future, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Two brothers from Central America face the same uncertain future here in the U.S., but they won't go back.
Yeah, it's hard here to live in constant fear of the police, of being caught up in a raid. But it's still better than going back to our countries, where the situation is so much worse.
Also, how a family-owned Chinese-American bank ended up fighting the federal government.
We feel that we were being picked on because we were easy prey.
Plus, the case for keeping one of London's most beloved Indian restaurants open.
There's an equality here. There's a mutual respect, mutual love. And it's not just food for thought, but food for stomach also.
Those stories, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have your company as we wade through a rainy Friday here in the Northeast. We're starting today's show talking about immigration, lots to discuss there, including a Supreme Court ruling on immigration detentions and a looming deadline for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. That's why here on The World, we're doing regular check-ins on the latest developments on immigration in this country. The World's Monica Campbell edits our Global Nation desk, and she's on the line with us. So let's start with this looming March 5th deadline coming up Monday, and this has to do with the DACA program. Remind us what happens on Monday.
Well, not a lot happens on Monday now. I mean, let's back up a little bit. Trump set this March 5th deadline, and it was seen as an arbitrary deadline when DACA would expire. And that deadline has now lost a lot of weight because we've had two recent court orders that have allowed people with DACA to renew their status, their ability to work and live in the United States as they have been. That said, it's still a program on life support. You hear this a lot. People ask, will the court ruling stick? Could it all come crashing down later this year? And also, the program is not accepting any new applicants. That's it. You're in the program, no new people.
And what about the movement for a permanent fix to DACA?
Well, the movement, when you talk to Dreamers, when you talk to people with DACA, I mean, they're still extremely united. They're pushing for Congress to get unified on this, to have a real long-term fix for them, for their families. You still have protests, and we're going to see a lot of protests and people marching to Washington and rallies next week. But it's a lot tougher because, in a way, those court rulings have it's a double-edged sword. It's allowed people with DACA to renew. It's allowed for some relief. But it's also taken the pressure off of Washington for that fix right away. You know, that immediate deadline is kind of gone. And now we also see, of course, a lot of attention turning to gun control. How much oxygen is in the room? You know, how much space is left for all of these huge pressing issues?
Also this week, Monica, we mentioned earlier the Supreme Court and a ruling there that had to do with immigration detentions. Explain what that was about.
Right. So this week, the Supreme Court ruled that some immigrants in detention centers do not have a right to bail hearings.
Right. Bail hearings. I mean, really important. If one gets arrested and detained, you've got the right to see a judge and try to post bail. That's how it works for everyone, right?
Well, that's not always been the case for non-citizens. So for years, immigrants in detention remained there, locked up for years without a chance at bail. Then a lawsuit changed all of that. And it centers on the case of a man. His name is Alejandro Rodriguez. He's an immigrant from Mexico. He came here as an infant. He eventually got a green card. And then when he was a teenager, he was convicted of joyriding and a minor drug possession. So he was detained. He was put in detention center. And he stayed there for 3 years, essentially behind bars.
So Mr. Rodriguez didn't get bail. He didn't even get a bail hearing.
For 3 years, he got no bail hearing. It was not an unusual case. This is a class action. Thousands of people like him. Eventually, the ACLU stepped in, got him released. He remains in the United States. But his case led to a court ruling that said that's not right. Immigrants who are detained have the right to get out on bail, at least try and seek bail. And now the government is pushing back on that right.
Why would the government now push back on detained immigrants having this right to a bail hearing?
Well, part of the government's argument is that it's not required to give immigrants a hearing, and that these hearings clog up a burdened immigration court system. And immigration activists say, whoa, does that mean we just have people locked up indefinitely in the U.S. without a chance to see a judge for bail? And we also know that the longer people are in detention, the more likely they'll throw in the towel and say, you know, I'm going to leave the country. And that brings up another concern. What if that immigrant has a good case for staying here? And I asked an immigration lawyer about this. His name is William Menar. He's in Pennsylvania. I asked him, what's the difference for an immigrant to fight their deportation from detention, behind bars essentially, or from the outside? And this is what he said.
It's night and day. First of all, the detention facilities are often hours away from cities or where most lawyers are, and they're frequently hours away from their family members to put together evidence. There are so many things that you can't do while in detention that you can do if the person is out and can really support their case.
And the numbers show that more immigrants successfully fight off deportation, win their cases, if they can work on them from outside detention.
Mm. What happens next in this case?
Well, the Supreme Court sent the case back to the lower court, to the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco, and there'll be new arguments, and it might not reach the Supreme Court again until 2020. But immigrant rights advocates worry that this is a red flag and that what we're seeing is a slide toward keeping people in detention centers, jails essentially, for years, and that it'll be tough considering that we have a pretty conservative Supreme Court.
The World's Monica Campbell, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
The president has a lot of discretionary power when it comes to immigration. He sets policies that can very quickly change the lives of people who have long ties to the U.S. or are escaping violence, change for the better or for the worse. The World's Anjali Shah is here to talk about the effects of some of these policy changes under Donald Trump. So have you seen this all play out?
Well, Marco, all over the country, we're seeing a lot of people really scrambling to figure out what to do as new policies come down. They have to often submit very complicated paperwork or save money for the fees and try to get in lines at often overworked bureaucracies. I'll give you an example. I live in Minnesota, and I met one family here from El Salvador in a particularly thorny situation because of the changes to immigration policy in the Trump administration. I met two brothers from El Salvador, both left for the U.S. because of the violence they experienced there. And I met their dad. They were really honest about their situation.
Yeah, so walk us through their immigration story, Anjali.
So David is in his 30s. He made a really risky journey by land using smugglers in 2002. Josue is his younger brother. He is 18, and he arrived by plane in 2016. So Josue was able to come legally, actually. He has what's called humanitarian parole, a discretionary, temporary status to live and work in the U.S. It was part of an Obama-era program, the Central American Minors Program.
Yeah, so the Central American Minors Program, that's not the same thing as DACA. What is that program about?
DACA is a temporary, also discretionary program, but for people who are already in the U.S.
Gotcha.
This one, the Central American Minors Program, was for kids who have ties to the U.S., parents in the U.S., who were stuck in their home countries, Guatemala, Honduras, or El Salvador, and in danger. So when the Central American Minors Program began in 2014, there were almost 70,000 kids caught at the southern border traveling alone. You probably remember that summer. It was pretty dramatic.
Yeah, I remember that summer. I just had forgotten how many kids we were talking about.
Yeah, it was a lot of kids. The Central American Minors Program, though, was a pretty small effort to allow parents legally here to bring their kids over. With CAM, just 3,260 were actually allowed to resettle in the U.S.
And Josue already had a parent in the U.S., right?
Yes. His dad has, and again, this is where, you know, immigration gets really complex. His dad has TPS, another temporary program, temporary protected status, which he got in 2001 because he was in the U.S. when El Salvador was struck by a very powerful earthquake. So Josue's dad has been here with that status for about 17 years.
What has changed for this family under the Trump administration?
So both TPS for Salvadorans and the Central American Miners Program have been canceled. So what that means is that Josue will lose his status in the fall. His dad will lose his status in 2019. So the family, which has been struggling to reunite for 15 years, has some really tough choices to make.
What options do they have?
Not a ton, but they will try to adjust their status, meaning they'll apply for another round of parole or maybe even green cards. They could potentially, like others, try to apply for asylum. But these are all kind of long shots for them. If these applications don't work, they have to choose. Do they all stay as undocumented people and risk arrest, or do they return to El Salvador? Here's what Josue says about trying to make that choice.
No sé, no tengo idea, pues, porque es muy complicado. Pues si uno regresa a su país, pues va con aquel...
I don't know. It's very complicated. You go from here, where you've lived so much better, and fall into that fear again. In a country where things are really, really dangerous, it's very different to go from here to there. And there, they think you have money because you've lived here. It's really complicated. I don't know what to do next.
Josue did say that it's possible and that he's worried that gang members could target him if he returns from the U.S. And Josue's older brother, David, doesn't want his younger brother to return.
Creo que es mejor que estar allá.
I think it's better than going back there, even after all these years that I've been here without documents. Yeah, it's hard here to live in constant fear of the police, of being caught up in a raid, but it's still better than going back to our countries, where the situation is so much worse. The uncertainty here is really hard, but it's the hope that keeps us going.
So, Anjali, now what? And what's life like for these brothers as they contemplate this really difficult decision?
You know, the family has been through a lot. Their faith and their church here gives them a lot of strength to just keep going. David has been fixing up his family's small house. He has a wife and three young children who were born in the U.S. They live in a part of Minnesota that's surrounded by farms and big open streets, and they're working. They have jobs, they're making a living, and they're paying taxes. It's hard for them, though. It's really difficult to have been separated and now have to make this kind of choice. David said something to me that I keep thinking about. I asked him what he wants Americans to know about his family. And this was the only time he became emotional.
Cuando yo vine a este país, dije, me gustó la manera como tratan a los animales, como cuidan a los animales, vegetación.
When I got to this country, I noticed how people here treated their animals, the kindness and the care they showed animals, and the land and the vegetation. I like that. And I thought, wow, what if they could treat us Hispanic people the same way? With that same kindness, they could at least treat us, you know, as human beings, instead of just treating us like terrorists and thinking of us as bad people.
Wow, that's pretty intense. It must really make them scratch their heads.
Yeah, and it becomes quite striking when you think about it that way. What this family wants is a home, and they've come to think of Minnesota as their home. So to have that, what they need is reform that both helps Central Americans leave violent situations and also at a broader level helps their countries to heal from decades of war and instability.
The World's Anjali Shah, thanks very much for introducing us to these two brothers, Josue and David, and their family.
My pleasure.
The U.S. played a big role in what has happened in El Salvador over the years. You can read more about that history and this family at PRI.org. Part of our series this week called Walls We Don't See. Coming up, Small Enough to Jail. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Oscars are on Sunday. It's gotten to the point that my household just wants to watch what happens on the red carpet. The rest, well, it's always interesting to hear the post-awards buzz. Other than that, I'm mostly interested in the best documentary category. Some of the best films that have come out of the Oscars are docs. Citizen 4, Searching for Sugar Man, Inside Job, real stories at play like actual feature films. We're pretty proud that one of this year's nominees was produced here at WGBH by our partners at Frontline. It's called Abacus, Small Enough to Jail.
People get the wrong impression that Chinese are not law-abiding.
This case is an attack on our community. We're easy prey.
Too big to fail turns into small enough to jail, and Abacus is small enough to jail.
It tells the story of the Abacus Federal Savings Bank, a family-owned bank in New York's Chinatown that catered to the immigrant community. Abacus was owned by the Sung family, and it became the only bank that was prosecuted in connection to the 2008 mortgage crisis. Abacus Small Enough to Jail was directed by Steve James, who was also behind the 1994 doc Hoop Dreams. Abacus follows the Sung family as it goes through 5 years of court battles. Vera Sung is one of the daughters who, along with her sisters, her mother, and father, has traveled to Los Angeles for the awards ceremony. So one of the things, Vera, that struck me about your story is that your trouble started because you all alerted authorities to irregularities in your book. So did you get in trouble because you were honest?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I had discovered it during a closing that I was doing for the bank that one of the loan officers at that closing was involved in some impropriety. And I immediately reported it to my sister, who's the president and CEO, Jill. And she actually fired him the next business day. We also reported it to our regulator and to Fannie Mae. It was actually not a complaint against the bank, but actually against this loan officer. So when the district attorney's office actually called us, we thought that they were helping us, were helping us to uncover improprieties that may be going on.
And then things snowballed from there. It's interesting that Abacus was the only U.S. lending institution to face criminal charges as compared to Goldman Sachs, which received a fine. Abacus was not a big bank. In fact, it was the 2,651st largest bank in the U.S., so that gives you a sense. Why was Abacus the only bank to face criminal charges after 2008?
We feel that we were being picked on because we were easy prey. We represent a minority community. We're founded by my father, who is a minority. We are owned by Chinese Americans, and we largely employ Chinese Americans, many of whom are immigrants. And I think that the district attorney felt that it would be easy to pick on us, even though it made no sense, being that our default rate was consistently, has been consistently, less than 0.5%. While during the 2008 financial crisis, the default rate was significantly larger. But he decided not to prosecute any of the large banks who are within his area, actually admitted to committing guilt. So to this day, believe that it was truthfully a discriminatory act against our community.
Is it possible that the district attorney was just focusing on Abacus to make an example of one bank?
Yes, we also feel that as well. The racial motivation part was the manner in which he conducted this investigation, the way he orchestrated the perp walk. So the perp walk scene was we had former employees all chained together and led down the courtroom halls in front of press. And it was obvious that it was staged. If you look carefully at that clip, which we looked at, and you can see the district attorney investigators, and they were all dressed up. You could see a bow tie and suit. Obviously, they knew that they were going to be in front of press. And then three of those individuals who were in this perp walk actually had already been arraigned and arrested. But it was actually a sad thing because two of them, one of them who was eventually exonerated after trial, he told me afterwards that during the trial, his mother had passed away and he wasn't able to go back. And for our culture, it's so important to go back.
Vera, you believe that if it had been Goldman Sachs facing criminal charges, there wouldn't have been a perp walk. Is that what I know it's a speculative question.
No, I definitely think there would not be a perp walk. And the idea that Goldman Sachs being indicted, they would never get indicted because all the big banks, they got deferred prosecution or a non-prosecution agreement and then a payment of a fine. We were never offered that. We were told you must plead guilty to a felony charge and also pay a fine. That was the choice that was given to the big banks has never been given to us, to the banks that were actually facing potential criminal charges.
Why did your father start Abacus in the first place?
He started it because he felt strongly that there was a need in the community to get financial services otherwise that they could not get. He himself, as an immigrant, and even as a lawyer, he had deposited money in banks. And then when it came time to borrow money, he could not borrow from the banks. They would give, you know, the excuses such as, we don't understand your language.
So, Vera, what do you want people to take away from your family story in this documentary?
We feel that the documentary and our experience has points out that there are issues with respect to the way big banks and small banks are treated and regulated. The disparity is actually very unfair. A lot of the large banks who actually committed a lot of the crime really helped to cause the 2008 financial crisis. Not the small banks and community banks such as ours,
right,
are treated in a different way because the collateral consequences of these large banks failing would be detrimental to the economy, whereas small community banks, that sentiment is not there. So small community banks play such a vital and important role. We actually serve people in the community that the big banks would not, who actually would turn them away or consider them not worth the time and the resources to serve. So we spend a lot of time trying to serve the underbanked community. And one of the most astounding moments when we were watching the film for the first time, we heard what he said. He said he would treat us the same as he would any other Indian or South American bank, which are minority banks.
This
he never
is
said
Cyrus
would,
Vance Jr.
Yes. He said he didn't say he would treat us the same as a large bank. And so it was very evident that there is an implicit bias or some sort of bias that he's not aware of that he has. And that was actually very upsetting and shocking to understand that. And my sister Chantrell, who actually was working for him, that she decided to leave and then help us defend the bank in this trial. She felt, I'm sure, betrayed by the office in a sense, but then ultimately felt that the system did not betray her, which is the criminal justice system, and that we fought within the criminal justice system, that we have a right to a fair trial and ultimately prevailed.
Well, as the Los Angeles Times said in its review, it's not every day that you end up rooting for a bank, but the story, Abacus Small Enough to Jail, they say, tells no ordinary tale. We'll see if the Academy agrees on Sunday. Vera Song, thanks very much for giving us this inside look at your family's bank. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Marco.
As we just heard, the Song family ultimately prevailed and was exonerated. As for the Abacus Federal Savings Bank, it's still operating, and Vera Song says business is better than ever. I'm Marco Werman. In 1968, the Beatles went on a famous trip to an ashram in India. And now, 50 years later, India is finally celebrating that.
Suddenly, India seems to have woken up to the fact that it played a major starring role in the history of the Beatles.
The Beatles in India, then and now. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The big economic story today is America First. President Trump says he'll slap tariffs on imports of steel and aluminum. World leaders have reacted angrily and have threatened retaliation, and that has many people now worried about a global trade war. The World's Jason Margolis joins me now. So, Jason, you cover economics for the show. Specifically, you've also reported about steel. So what's going on here? Why is President Trump saying he's going to slap these tariffs on steel and aluminum?
Right. So President Trump basically says that China is dumping steel and aluminum here in the United States. And dumping means selling steel for less than what it costs to make. And we just can't compete with that.
So who would these tariffs actually benefit?
So it would benefit steel and aluminum makers here in the United States. You go down to these communities in western Pennsylvania and where they make steel, and this is where President Trump went and helped him win the election. He went to these communities like Manesson, Pennsylvania, and he said, I'm going to bring back steel jobs. And all these people who were union people who voted Democrats say, this is our guy, and they voted for Trump. And he appears to be fulfilling his campaign promise.
How many people work in America's steel industry?
About 150,000.
And is it certain that these tariffs will get them jobs?
No, there's no certainty in that. So President Obama argued that, look, we still produce pretty similar amounts of steel that we were making 20 years ago, but the jobs are far less because machines are so much better. It's so highly mechanized that even if we were to go back to the steel production of the 1970s, the jobs would not come back in the same numbers.
Who would be hurt by these tariffs?
A lot of people. So you and I would be hurt because the cost of products that include aluminum and steel would go up. That's everything from our cars to our aluminum foil to our bikes to you name it. We wouldn't be hurt that much because aluminum and steel is only a component of automobiles. But the people who would really be hurt are the people who produce those products because they're going to have to pay more for their steel and their aluminum. And it's going to be hard for them to pass much higher costs onto us. Because are we really going to pay more for a Ford car when we can go buy a Toyota?
So as I said earlier, some economists are warning about a trade war as a result of all of this. What would that look like if it happens?
Threats are already out there. And Europe is saying, if you do this, we are going to put tariffs on Kentucky bourbon. Why do you think they chose that?
Mitch McConnell is from Kentucky.
There you go. Mitch McConnell's from Kentucky.
That gets personal.
Yeah. And they also saying they're going to put tariffs on Harley Davidson's coming into Europe. Why did they choose Harley Davidson's, which are made in Wisconsin?
Paul Ryan.
Bingo, you're two for two. So then it's a tit for tat. So Europe says, we're going to put tariffs on products you're trying to sell us. And then the United States says, okay, you're going to do that. Well, we're going to put tariffs on cheese coming from France or whatever. And where does it end? And that's the big fear. And that's what ultimately made the Great Depression far more severe is these protectionist measures.
So on balance, tell us if this is a good move or a bad move.
Depends who you ask. The people in Manesson, Pennsylvania are jumping for joy today. They see relief coming, long-needed relief, and it's legitimate. Those communities have really been hurt. Now, if you ask economists, most economists say this is a bad move. And there's a very nice new website. It's called EconoFact, and it tackles issues in very short, easy-to-understand ways. It's geared at policymakers and journalists and just anyone who wants to understand issues. And they had a memo this week, and it says, "Will steel tariffs put U.S. jobs at risk?" It's written by Lydia Cox and Katie Russ at Harvard and UC Davis. And one very telling number, just listen to this. The number of jobs in U.S. industries that use steel or inputs made of steel outnumber the number of jobs involved in the production of steel by roughly 80 to 1.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, so what we're saying is President Trump is trying to help that one person at the expense of the other 80. Now, if you're that one person, fantastic. But if you're among those other 80, you're going to be a little worried today.
The world's Jason Margolis. Thanks for explaining this to us.
Thank you.
The U.S. isn't alone when it comes to imposing tariffs. In Canada, the dairy market is regulated through a system of quotas and tariffs, and the Trump administration says that unfairly keeps American producers out of Canada. A familiar response from Canada, we're simply protecting our domestic industry with sensible regulations. But inside Canada, those same regulations have been blamed for high prices at the cheese counter, which has led some cheese lovers to smuggle. Nate Tabak has that story from Toronto.
Clara is a student living in Toronto. She's French, and she's flying home to Paris in a couple days for a visit. While she's there,
I go to the fromagerie, get a nice flock of Comté.
Comté is kind of like Gruyere, but made under strict rules in the French Alps.
It's easy to bring back because it's not gooey, and you know it's not going to like give a scent to your entire suitcase.
Clara usually gets around 2 to 4 pounds. But she gets nervous when she lands in Canada and goes through passport control.
I'm also a terrible liar, and I hate lying. So every time I, like right before I have to talk to the person at the border, that's when I'm like, oh, they're going to ask me if I have food. Oh, probably shouldn't mention that I have cheese in my suitcase.
When they ask you that, what do you say?
I'm like, nope. Yeah, I don't usually say anything. I stress a little bit, and then it's usually over in 2 minutes and nothing happens, so.
Clara's done this 6 times, but she worries about getting caught, so she asked me not to use her last name. She breaks the rules because Comté is a lot cheaper in France.
See, 8.20 for 100 grams.
Is that a lot?
Yes.
We're looking at a piece that's around $30 US a pound. In France, it's anywhere from a quarter to half that. It's not just Comté. Cheese tends to be pricey in Canada. Pricier than other cheese-loving countries, including the U.S. So cheese smuggling is a thing here. A few years ago, an organized smuggling ring was broken up in Niagara, Ontario.
For months, police have been sniffing around pizza shops in Fort Erie asking about cheese.
It involves thousands of pounds of cheaper American mozzarella being smuggled across the border. A cop actually went to jail for it. It's not just the price, though. It's a limited selection.
Getting cold out there, eh?
Serena Pararajasingham owns Uptown Brie. It's a cheese shop in Toronto's midtown. Sometimes her customers ask her to smuggle cheese for them.
Customers who are, like, really good customers who, you know me from, like, day one, they would come in and they'd say, oh, are you able to bring that? Because they know, like, you know, and I still have to say I'm sorry.
Pararajasingham probably isn't the best person to ask. She was a corrections officer before she started selling cheese. But she sympathizes with her customers because sometimes it's hard supplying them with their favorite cheese. Like this one from Spain. It's called Don Heliodoro, and it looks like it's covered in petrified moss.
This is definitely a good one.
What's on there?
It's actually covered in rosemary wax. It's quite nice. So give that a try.
Oh, wow.
I will try some, too. That's delicious.
She can't always get Don Heliodoro from her suppliers, and it usually sells out pretty quickly, even though it costs around $33 a pound here.
So one of the big problems that we can't get a lot of international cheeses is because of our quota regulations here in Canada.
That's Cecilia Smith. She's a professional fromager, kind of like a sommelier, but for cheese. We're sampling cheese at the St. Lawrence Market in Toronto. And there's a very specific kind of Pecorino Romano she wants me to try.
You don't have any of that, okay?
Smith is from England. She smuggled a lot of cheese since she moved to Canada. She says it's mostly stuff she can't get here and that she wants to try.
When you start talking to people, everybody does, well, lots of people do it.
She started declaring her cheese at the border 4 years ago, but she still brings in more than she's allowed to.
Feel bad?
No. There are worse things.
But you're disrupting the market. I mean, I think that's the argument for the protection.
Okay. So if we get on down, right down to the morals, then yes, I probably am disrupting the market.
These rules are there to protect Canada's dairy producers, including Mountain Oak in rural Ontario. There's no cheese to be seen here, just a murky pool. Then Adam von Berchig flips a switch. A chain slowly pulls up a metal shelf. On it, 16 wheels of Gouda, dripping with saltwater brine. Van Berchig owns Mountain Oak with his wife, Hanny. They're from the Netherlands. It all started because they missed the cheese from back home.
We couldn't find what we were looking for. So that's one of the reasons that we finally started to make cheese ourselves.
Their Gouda is winning awards, and business is growing. So is competition, including cheaper Gouda from the Netherlands. It's part of a new trade deal with the EU.
I'm never worried about competition. Competition keeps us sharp, as long as we are all on the same play level.
That's why he supports Canada controlling cheese imports with quotas and tariffs. They help balance the fact that cheese producers in the US and the EU are using cheaper subsidized milk.
And over here, we don't get any subsidy.
Van Berchig worries that Canada might ease these import controls because of U.S. pressure, but he's confident his Gouda can hold its own. As for Clara, she made a tough decision in France. She left the Comté behind because her suitcase was overweight. Though she did bring a few pounds of chocolate, Canada has limits on that too. But Clara didn't declare hers as required, so technically, she smuggled it. For The World, Nate Tabak, Toronto.
In Egypt, the government has little tolerance for dissent, especially now in the run-up to this month's presidential elections there. And lately, it's entertainers who are being targeted for censorship and even jail time. Take Egyptian pop star Shireen Abdelwahab, who this week was handed a 6-month prison sentence after cracking a joke during a concert. We called up Egyptian-American author Mona El-Tahawi to talk about this. She says a singer known by many simply as Shireen is a very popular figure in Egypt.
She's on one of those shows, you know, those talent shows where she's one of the judges.
Right.
She's one of the biggest names in the region. So this is really shocking.
So let's hear a bit of the song that got Shireen in such trouble. This is called Have You Drunk from the Nile? So Mona, tell us what the song is about.
Well, the song comes from this Egyptian phrase that basically, if you drink from the Nile, you're going to come back. You know, every country has its own version of this. So, and the song is, you know, basically a song for the love of Egypt. And apparently what happened at one of Shireen's concerts that landed her into this trouble was that a fan requested this song. And Shireen, in response, you know, the song is called Have You Drunk from the Nile? And Shireen joked, well, you know, you're better off not drinking from the Nile because you're going to get bilharzia, which is a waterborne disease from a parasite that is found in the Nile that has long plagued Egypt. So she was making a joke and she was saying, you know, you're better off drinking. And then she says the name of a mineral water company. So it was a joke.
So just to be clear, bilharzia, or some people call it schistosomiasis, this waterborne bacteria, Egypt has made great strides, as you say, in reducing it. But it's still dangerous to drink from the Nile, right? I mean, that is a problem.
It is dangerous to drink from the Nile. There are parts of the Nile where if you go in, you will get this parasite that carries this disease. And so, you know, she was joking, but she's joking about something that is real. And I think what it reminds Egyptians is that Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, our current president, who is from the military and who is military-backed, is showing an increasing sensitivity to any kind of criticism. So it's not just unknown university students who are picked up in the middle of the night and forcibly disappeared. And we've had hundreds of such cases. But this is also kind of muscle flexing and saying, look, even the most famous pop stars are not immune from our strength. This is a message to everyone. We can get whoever we want.
It's interesting because the same day Shireen was convicted, another court in Cairo sentenced a lesser-known singer, Leila Amer, to 2 years in prison for inciting debauchery in a music video. It's titled Bas Umek, or Look at Your Mother. So, Mona, what's going on in this music video, and what's the subtext?
The subtext here is many things. I mean, the title of the song, Bosommak, rhymes very, very closely with a very, very lewd, pejorative, it's a curse, a very popular curse in Egypt. So this is a play on words, but it's also a video that you can only find on YouTube. And it is one of several videos that have got less well-known female singers into trouble because they're accused of inciting debauchery, they're accused of being immoral, they're accused of showing too much flesh, whether it's cleavage or leg, and being very sexually suggestive. And this is a case of the regime understanding very well the conservatism that is at play in Egypt that unites not just pro-Sisi people, but also more religiously conservative people, whether they're Muslim Brotherhood or not. And this is a message that says, we are a conservative country, and there is a very particular way of being a good woman in Egypt. It's a regime basically flexing its religious and moral muscles and trying out basically on people considered quote unquote deviant to see how far it can go. So when you combine all of those into one picture, it is a picture of a strong man who is insistent that I'm in charge, I'm in control, and I will not brook any criticism, even jokes about Egypt.
Egyptian-American author Mona El-Tahawi, always good to speak with you. Thanks.
Thank you for having me on, Marco.
One of the oldest Indian restaurants in Britain is under threat. The India Club was established in the late 1940s to give Indian diplomats and expatriates in London a place to meet and dine. Sure, it's switched locations over the years, but it's still around and it's become famous for its authentic food and ambience. But the India Club is now under threat from developers who want to turn its current location into a hotel. Kasum Vadgama remembers the restaurant's early days. She grew up under British rule in India and moved to London in the early 50s as a university student. Vadgama told The World's Leo Hornack how the India Club quickly became home away from home.
It was absolutely delicious. Curry, you know, the spices. No. It was a welcome treat, I tell you. You look forward to it. You dream about it. I arrived here not knowing a soul in London. I just didn't know anybody at all. And by coincidence, I discovered that there was an India Club. And I used to go to college every day of the week, and then Saturday was free. What do I do? In the room, you had no TV, no telephone. So I thought I'd try, and I went there. And instantly, I was in love with the place. One of the reasons was that there were English people there. And when you come from a colony where they look down upon you and you come here and they look like a friend, it takes a little bit of an adjustment. And I found it very, very interesting, very welcoming, very fascinating that I could be treated as an equal rather than some kind of coolie somewhere in one of the colonies.
It's interesting that one of your memories is you went to the India Club and you learnt about the English, really.
Yes, absolutely, because that is the closest I could get. This is the only place, even today, I feel that there's an equality here. There's a mutual respect, mutual love, and that is what India Club has been. And it's not just food for thought, but food for stomach also.
Yes. Tell me what the food is like back when you first came there in the 50s.
There weren't many Indian restaurants in 1953 in this country. For a vegetarian, it was impossible to get anything except beans on toast. And that is what I sort of, I didn't eat eggs, so I'm afraid my staple diet was beans on toast. It was very limited, you know, everything boiled potatoes and boiled vegetables.
Now that there's a threat that it might have to close, how does that make you feel?
I feel very sad about it because it's not just a building of bricks. It has got a little bit of spirit in it. It's got, it has a history behind it. And I, as a historian, cannot accept the fact that you can uproot and destroy it the way that they are planning to do, which is unfair. It is unnecessary. And the irony of it is that we spent 200 years getting rid of British and now they're getting rid of us here in a little place. It seems unfair.
Historian Kusum Vadgama speaking there with the world's Leah Hornack in London. India House is one cultural holdover of the British colonial project in India. Here's another. It's been 50 years since the Beatles famously traveled to an ashram in the Himalayan foothills of northern India. If you're of a certain age, you'll remember that moment. The beads, the sitars, the entourage, and the lasting musical influence on George Harrison. It's so evocative that even Indians are marking the anniversary of the Beatles' trip to Rishikesh. Sandeep Roy is a writer and journalist based in Kolkata. He spent 20 years living in the U.S. before returning home to India. So lots of Americans of a certain age remember this big trip, a lot of hoopla. But how's it being remembered in India?
Funnily, I don't remember a big hoopla about, say, the 25th anniversary, but the 50th anniversary seems to have got a lot more attention. There's a Beatles festival happening as part of a yoga festival in Rishikesh, where they originally went. And a tribute band from England called the Fab Four is supposed to come and perform there. So suddenly India seems to have woken up to the fact that it played a major starring role in the history of the Beatles.
So this is kind of a reappreciation in India of 50 years ago. It's not like the Beatles have been like very popular this whole time.
The Beatles have always been popular here, but I spoke with a journalist named Ojoy Bose, who has just recently written a book about the 50th anniversary, about the Beatles coming to India, called Across the Universe. He was around at that time, and he said, you know, he was very excited. He used to fight with his father about being allowed to keep his hair long, but he also told me that at that time, not all Indians were that pleased about these international celebrities coming to India. He said that while there was a lot of Beatlemania, there was also a lot of Beatlephobia.
There was very strong opposition in Parliament to this Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's ashram and these international celebrities like the Beatles coming. The communists felt that there were CIA spies.
So people in India, some people thought the Beatles were spies for the CIA?
Well, they had long hair and they were English, but, you know, they were from the West. So I think at that time in India, people were very suspicious of what they called the foreign hand. You know, I think a lot of people just didn't approve of the Beatles in general, and CIA spy seemed like a good tag to put on them.
I mean, we have to remember this is 1968. There was no internet. Over 10 years ago, I had the chance to speak with writer and editor Lewis Lapham from Harper's, who went to see what all the fuss was about. I just want us to hear Lapham describing arriving in Delhi and just setting off for this ashram.
I asked the driver to take me to Rishikesh, and the driver looked at me and smiled broadly and said, "Yes, we go Beatles," because everybody in Delhi knew that the Beatles were either present or soon arriving in Rishikesh. People were talking about it in the streets. There were those who were great fans of the Beatles and thought this was a wonderful thing indeed. And then there were other Indian newspapers who tended to be skeptical. Here come rich Westerners to borrow the ancient wisdom.
And Sandeep, what do we know, though, about what actually happened in Rishikesh once the Beatles got there?
Well, I also got a chance to speak with Philip Norman, who's a very well-known rock biographer and rock historian. And he said, you know, while they actually sincerely came to learn transcendental meditation with the Mahesh Yogi, what they landed up in was really more of a spa.
Yeah, they just had to sit around, eat nice vegetarian food, and they could drink. You know, things were smuggled, pot was smuggled into them, you know. In the end, it became a bit too non-spiritual.
In fact, not only was it non-spiritual, you know, they got a bit of the Delhi belly as well, I guess, because Ringo Starr apparently had a very weak stomach anyway. So he was so terrified of Indian food and its spices that he actually took an entire suitcase of Heinz baked beans with him. And when the baked beans finished, I think it was time for Ringo to leave.
Sandeep Roy, a writer and journalist based in Kolkata, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Sexy Sadie, what have you done? You made a fool of everyone.
Sexy Sadie, one song that came out of the Rishikesh experience. John and Paul actually wrote it about the Maharishi. Our own theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg and, by the way, features tablas. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here Monday.
You broke the rules. You laid it down for all to see.
PRI, Public Radio International.